Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, February 7th, 2023. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, over 5,000 dead in Turkey and Syria in the wake that massive earthquake. Expect more deaths, those numbers to rise. Meanwhile, Biden to deliver State of the Union address tonight, which may be his last national primetime speech before we know his reelection plans. Then, Sarah Huckabee Sanders to do a GOP response.
Oh, girl boss. I mean, how did she get to that position at such a young age? Oh, wait.
Delia Ramirez will be doing the WFP response. And we may be doing coverage of all of it tonight, ladies and gentlemen. More on that later. The Republican Center folds. So-called moderates say no clean debt ceiling increase. Federal judge says abortion rights still may exist in the Constitution, but instead embedded in the 13th Amendment. Neo-Nazi leader arrested in a plot to attack the Baltimore power grid. New report, our healthcare system? A disaster. Also, another report, FBI paid a provocateur to sabotage the Colorado Black Lives Matter protests. House looks to vote to condemn Chinese balloons. Crooked media workers unionize. And just as a bonus, apparently the Jimmy Dore show requires its workers to sign a non-disclosure agreement.
Whoa.
Spicy. All this and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. It is Tuesday. Which?
Newsday Tuesday?
Yes.
Yes.
Our co-host, Emma Vigeland, says Tuesday, Newsday. Here we go.
I think Newsday, Tuesday feels
Newsday,
better.
Tuesday. We got let me center myself there a little bit. Matt is out of town, so our graphics department is on vacation for the day.
Bradley's doing two jobs.
He's doing a great job.
Yeah.
He's doing a great job, but we let off our graphics people today. So
people don't realize we operate our own cameras, like literally with a remote control because of all the peacock money.
Someone just breached their NDA and owes me $10,000. You imagine that?
Yeah.
Like, I'm in the same business.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea that it has never, ever, ever occurred to me to impose a NDA on people here, I feel like it's a missed opportunity. And also the idea that it would charge like a $10,000 a fee, and it's more, and they all seem to be contractors, which, you know, early on in this program, Matt and Mike and Dorsey was working early on, and Evan and Hillary and Kelly, for the most of like the first couple of early years, it was contractors. And that always, I wanted to do payroll because people need Social Security. We just weren't making that much money. I mean, it's arguable as to whether some of those positions at that time were contractor status or not. And I guess, you know, he does his show once a week, so I can see maybe it's all contractor. But the NDA thing is really nuts. And I can understand it, too, if it was like, you know, I don't want you talking about how much, you know, me and my wife argue.
I or see, how much I drink in, over the course of a day. Yeah, just as an example for other people.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, or, you know, and I could see like an NDA regarding like sort of personal things. But I mean, it is a weird, weird thing to have people sign.
And it's suspiciously anti-worker.
It's very anti-worker.
It just is interesting, right? Like there's tropes about who workers are and who workers aren't. People like Dorr don't seem to consider teachers to be workers when he advocates for them, or the people that work for him, for that matter.
That's right. There's an aesthetic when he talks about workers.
Right.
Daredevil on the IMs had a good point, though. Sam, you should have made Saul sign an NDA before his guest spot last year. Probably that would have been a good suggestion. I don't know if he would abide by it. And he has his own representation at this point. So, but let's get in on this. It looks like we're going to be doing coverage tonight of the State of the Union. And it is going to be it should be interesting in just insofar as you know, what Biden's agenda is going to be and whether he runs for re-election. I mean, I don't know that we would find out tonight, but we would get a sense maybe. Don't know if he's made that decision or not. We shall see. For the moment, the Republicans seem to sort of like be dying down on their hysteria over the Chinese balloon, in part because there's now documents out that show that the Chinese balloons were traveling around the country as early as during the Trump administration, crossing Hawaii and Florida. And clearly they tried to see if they could go a different route this time. Here is the five? Yeah, this is the five. And Judge Jeanine is very upset about these Chinese balloons.
Child tax credits.
I, you know what? I'm going to time myself and see how long I can last listening to him. First of all, 62% of Americans think that Joe Biden hasn't accomplished very much. So, you know, you can have, you know, Jessica, you can say X, Y, and Z. And I really think the reason that he came through in the midterms that the Democrats did, I think it was all about abortion, 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 abortion. And I don't think it was a testament to how great Joe Biden is. The truth is,
pause it for 1 second. We're going to talk more about that 62% who don't think that Biden has done anything, which, you know, I think they've got to be aware of the White House. And we're going to see a speech that is tailored towards touting some of those things, some of which are good, some of which didn't, you know, certainly a lot of promises unkept. Some promises kept. The problem that Pirro has here is that abortion thing, as she calls it, that's not going away.
No.
In fact, you know, it's just going to get worse every day going forward. So,
and now it's inexplicable. It's completely tied to the Republicans' branding as well, which is one of extremism, of chaos, and of being, you know, far right theocrats. So, like, it's not just the abortion thing; it's the entire party in one issue, basically.
And at the end of the day, like, who cares about Joe Biden as a person as much as I'm going to vote for the people who are going to try and restore the first individual right taken away by the Supreme Court in the history of this country, probably. But an individual right that existed in this country for 60 years. But
in fact, though, just on that point really quickly, his boringness almost acts as a nullifier for all of their crazy. Like he is not a sponge who's able to absorb the conspiracy theories and crazy. So they don't really know how to attack him. But
right. It's just that people don't like you. They just don't want to have the fact that their bodies are controlled by some creepy old guys.
60% of the country thinks we're on the wrong track. People can't afford food anymore. Only 31% of the country thinks the man is competent. They think he's incompetent. And if you don't think This so-called balloon, which is a euphemism for a Chinese spy craft, if you don't think that impacts Americans in a very unusual way, we're not used to them being over our land. This is the homeland. This is America. They're now buying millions of acres near these intercontinental ballistic missile sites so that they can, what, grow corn and then have an impact on our food supply. It's not what we think it is. I really believe that, you know, Americans recognize inflation isn't transitory, that he surrendered to the Taliban, and that all of the bad stuff, if they can at least bring it out in terms of the fentanyl crisis, the southern border, what's going on in the air and the border, you know, they don't want, as someone said this, they don't want cheap talking points. They want something that reflects who they are as Americans and how they can survive in the next few years.
I wish that we could have heard the inner monologues of all those people sitting around the table with her. Like, wait, what? Wait, well, hold on. China. First of all, inflation.
Fentanyl.
Yeah, but the Chinese know how to grow corn now, I guess.
To the extent that I could sort of parse out what she's saying there, inflation, it has been transitory, actually. We got a good clip of Jared Bernstein in a minute, but inflation has been waning. And this is a problem for them. Like, what the reason why we played that up front is because Pierrot's sort of like hodgepodge of like the balloon is actually real for me. Really, like, the most real aspect of that balloon for people would be like, oh my God, kids, come out here, check out that balloon. It's so cool.
Yeah,
like,
right.
That's about it. It's like seeing a blimp or something.
Or a UFO.
It's exciting. But the idea that there's actually genuine concern amongst Americans about this Chinese balloon is just absurd. And she's got to dance around with all these different things. I mean, this is part of the problem the Republicans have. They're going to go out there. They've got Kevin McCarthy going out there trying to drum up like some type of angst over the federal debt and their debt ceiling crashing, and it's just not working for them anymore because they abandoned that in about three hot seconds when it came back in the day. Donald Trump has that whole sort of deficit debt hysteria. Donald Trump has said, don't touch Medicare and Social Security, which are really... Everybody knows there's two places where there's money. This government basically does two things. Provides social insurance, not enough in my estimation, but provides social insurance, old age, and essentially like catastrophic poverty insurance. And then has a massive military.
Yeah.
And you got to cut from one of those two places. Much harder to cut Social Security and Medicare because of what people say. Hard to cut defense spending because of what corporations say. And there's just not enough wokeness in the military to find that money.
Polite disagreement. I think there's more than enough wokeness for us to cut. Please. Come on.
If you're looking to cut the woke stuff, it's going to be tough. I think if you're looking to cut like the massive... The massive redundancy in our military. Like, you know, we could just have the biggest military in the world if we wanted, and we could cut about half of our military budget tomorrow.
Aren't we
maybe
the biggest
a little bit more?
Four times over?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think we could cut. No. We're bigger than the entire rest of the world combined. And if we cut half of our budget tomorrow, we would still have the biggest military budget out there.
I'm just saying that there's wokeness hiding under every corner, every nook and cranny within the military, and it's subtext. You have to try to find it to cut it. Did she also say that fentanyl prices were too high, or did I mishear that? She moves
so quickly. I couldn't figure out.
She's just reading a word cloud. It looks like from that Fox sends out.
Yeah.
We're going to talk more about. That question of inflation and the State of the Union sort of, I don't know, I guess preview in just a second. Also, a big report out by the Commonwealth Fund on just how much of a disaster our healthcare system is. And speaking of which, we're also going to be losing. We could have anywhere from 5 to really 15 million people lose healthcare come May because of changes in Medicaid as a function of having the COVID emergency rolled back. But we'll talk about that in a second. Oh, this is a good sponsor. We have a real, I think everybody knows this, plastic problem in the world. Never mind just the country. 40% of the world's plastic has been created in the past 18 years, which is, and that plastic is going to be here well beyond all of us being alive. You've seen like images of like that huge plastic island in the ocean, garbage. There's got to be a better way to deal with this. And, you know, ultimately, we're going to need some type of legislation. But in the meantime, what you can do is to change what you do in terms of like one-time disposable plastics. Hold On is a company born from that idea that there must be a better way to go about our daily chores. They have trash bags and kitchen bags, which, of course, everybody needs to use them, but they don't need to be 100% plastic. In fact, they don't need to be plastic at all. Hold On trash bags and kitchen bags are heavy-duty, plant-based, non-toxic, and 100% home compostable. I guess they're technically plastic, but they're not forever plastic, which means that they break down in weeks, not decades. They don't fill up our landfills. They do not pollute our oceans and our seas. They got Zip Seal kitchen bags, which come in sandwich or gallon bag sizes. So you can put your kids, I don't know, carrot sticks or crayons or mix them up together. Doesn't matter. Hold On also has... They have like little tiny bags that I use for
sandwiches,
snacks, but also for cat poop. And I have like a medium size bags. I got all sorts of different size Hold On bags. Single use plastic is the worst kind of plastic at every stage of it. Production, disposal, decomposition. They're harming our earth and you can do something about it. The Hold On bags are made from non-toxic ingredients. They are made from plant-based renewables. The trash and kitchen bags meet the highest standards of compostability and break down in weeks, not in centuries. They're great. I mean, I don't mind getting rid of like all the cat poop out of the house immediately. I don't feel like I got to save up the bags because I don't want to create that much garbage. I don't know what to tell you. They work like bags, except for they're not going to exist forever.
Bags without the guilt.
No, exactly. If you want to shop some plant-based bags and replace single-use plastics all over your home, easy to do. Visit holdonbags.com/majority or enter majority at checkout. You will save 20% off your order. Sustainability has never been more simple. That's H-O-L-D-O-N, Hold On Bags, all one word, .com/majority or enter majority. Receive 20% off your order. Small things can lead to lasting change if we stop and say, Hold On. Appreciate Hold On for sponsoring this episode and for, you know, allowing me to get rid of my cat poop in my house guilt-free. We will put a link to that, of course, in the YouTube and podcast description. Also, another one of my... I don't know what you call these. One of my little neuroses that has become much easier for me to deal with, and that is I do not want my identity stolen. I do not want to go through the hassles of having to change credit cards. I don't want my email accounts to be hacked. I don't want my Twitter account to be hacked. I don't want any of that. How do I make sure that doesn't happen? I use Aura.com. They are sponsoring today's program. They are Aura is an easy-to-use app. It includes everything you need to stay safe online. It protects you from scammers and from hackers. It scans the so-called dark web, and you know, where basically people sell and trade information on what they have hacked or phished or whatnot, and alerts you if your email is on there, if your passwords are on there, even if your social security is on there, so that you know what's up. You can change your passwords, you can change your emails, you can make sure that your social security number is secure. I have found a lot of breached password and email combinations that I've been able to change. You never know when it what that has stopped going forward. They also, which I really appreciate, is send repeated automatic, takedown requests to all those sites that make your public information public, your address, your name, your phone number, that kind of stuff. Helps reduce robocalls and creeps creeping on you. They also give you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit activity. So somebody's trying to like take a car loan out in your name, or somebody's trying to get a credit card in your name, you'll know about it. Somebody's trying to open up a fake bank account, or anything that would require any type of credit check, they will let you know. I went through this when I opened up a bank account for Mila. Got a little message. Hey, heads up, somebody's opened an account here. It was me, but it was good to know that they're on top of it. They have a VPN that allows you to stay anonymous online, keeps you browsing into history and your personal information safe and encrypted. They have a virus, malware, spyware protection for all of your devices. Makes it harder for bad guys to mess around with your stuff. They also have a way to manage what your kids use on their devices. So you can keep them from watching YouTube when they're supposed to be doing their homework, or, tell them they've got X amount of time over the course of the day. Much better when a device does it in terms of arguments with the kids, believe me. They also have a password manager, lets you store and access your online passwords securely and conveniently. And the beauty about Aura is, it's one app that does all of these like seven different functions. You don't need to get seven different apps. Let Aura do the hard work keeping you safe online. If you sign up right now, Aura is going to give you a 2-week free trial with my link. But you put in your email, you'll see how much Aura finds for you almost immediately in terms of what has been exposed. Go to aura.com/majority. That's aura.com/majority. Start your free trial. It, of course, will be linked in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. All right, let's get into this. Judge Jeanine made a point of saying that Americans are not feeling what's happening with the Biden administration. And in some instances, I think, some of it is legit. But they don't even seem to be knowing what's going on and what the Biden administration the Democrats have done in Congress. And so there's obviously more work to be done, at least letting people know, because the more that people understand there's a direct connection between what their government does and what their daily life is like, it's important. 62% of Americans think Biden has accomplished not very much, little or nothing. 36% say he's accomplished a great deal or good amount. So much of this is influenced by just sort of like their predisposition towards Biden. 77% of Democrats say he's accomplished a lot. 32% amongst political independents. He's in a worse situation. I think it was when Obama sought re-election, 52% of adults said he accomplished not much, as opposed to 62%. 3 in 10 Americans. And this is where the interesting part comes in. 3 in 10 Americans say Biden has made progress lowering prescription drug costs, while 47% say he is not. 23% are unsure. Starting this last month, Medicare recipients have a $35 cap on insulin. That's saving hundreds of dollars a month minimum for folks with diabetes who are in Medicare.
And Biden is expected to put that at the forefront tonight in State of the Union, and also advocate for expanding it to everybody, which I think is an effective tack.
And the point is, the reason why he's calling for it to be expanded for everybody is to let the other people know that it's actually happened to them, and to take credit for it. They say that Biden has 26% Americans say that he has improved the affordability of electric vehicles. To the extent that people are interested in this, I don't know how much they are. I suspect a significant portion of the population is. But the fact is that they've made them significantly more inexpensive with tax credits. A third of adults say Biden's made progress in creating, and this is tricky, more good jobs in their community, while 60% says he has not. There has been the fastest pace of job growth in U.S. history. The unemployment rate is lower than it's been in 50 years. To the extent that these are better jobs, I think that's arguable. And, you know, Jared Bernstein will say that some of them are manufacturing. They've certainly brought back a bunch of manufacturing jobs. But I think jobs just in general are crappier than they used to be, frankly.
Yeah.
Because...
and wages are increasing, but not increasing at the rate that that growth or price of goods was increasing with inflation.
Over the past 6 months, that's not the case, though.
Yeah.
Actually, over the past couple of, like, 3 or 4 months, we've actually seen a real wage increase of like 0.3%. That's not huge, but it is outpacing inflation at this point in terms of the relative way they're growing. But I don't know that people feel that at this point. A growing number of Americans say their own financial circumstances are worsening on Biden's watch. 4 in 10 Americans say they're not as well off financially since Biden became president, up from 35% a year ago. So it's a 6% change. However, this, I think, is a function, and this is where the failure to pass the Build Back Better bill came in. There's another story where Americans' savings are dropping dramatically. They were able to save over the past, like in 20 and 21, to some extent, because of things like the American Rescue Act.
Right.
Which put $300 per kid in every parent's bank account each month. There was $2,000 worth of checks from December of 2020 to February, I guess it was, of 2021, and people have drawn down those savings in part because of higher prices
and return to more normal economic activity post-COVID,
exactly,
as well.
There's some questions about Ukraine. Doesn't seem like it's terribly significant, but those are the big numbers. And so this is a preview. Jared Bernstein, longtime economic advisor to Joe Biden. I don't know if he's in the administration at the moment. I think he is.
He's in the Council of Economic Advisors, the CEA.
When Biden was vice president, I know that Bernstein was in there. He's a pretty, you know, as far as economists go, and certainly ones that make it into the White House, on the progressive side of things. But here he is on Fox News with, what's her name?
Shannon Bream.
That is great news for the country, for the administration, for the president, for what you're working on. But it hasn't gotten to people's real life yet. So let's take a look at what they're dealing with. 166 million Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. The majority of people who are making more than $100,000 a year say that includes them living paycheck to paycheck. Retail spending's been down in several recent months. Inventory's up. Inflation has outpaced wage growth for 21 months. And gas prices are up again the last 5 weeks in a row. So when does the good news get to our real lives?
Well, let me do a couple of quick fact checks on some of those.
Pause it for 1 second. And this is going to be important in a second. And just go back a little bit here. But those numbers in terms of the paycheck to paycheck and the 100,000, even 51% making 100,000 plus, say they're living paycheck to paycheck. Healthcare has got to be one of the biggest drivers of this. I mean, it's rent and healthcare that has really gone through the roof and has, you know, I think has just immiserated people. And it may take a while for rents to come down. But there are things that we could do about healthcare that are, you know, far less dramatic and far more national than let's say rents per se. I mean, we need to build more, and the Fed is making that very difficult by raising interest rates. But that's where those numbers come from.
Continue. $1,000 a year, say that includes them living paycheck to paycheck. Retail spending's been down in several recent months, and inventory's up. Inflation has outpaced wage growth for 21 months, and gas prices are up again the last 5 weeks in a row. So when does the good news get to our real lives?
Well, let me do a couple of quick fact checks on some of those statements. So first of all, actually, real wages have been growing for the past 6 or 7 months. And one reason for that is because, again, unlike one of the bullet points there, gas prices came down sharply in the month of December. They turned around a bit, partially in January. But one of the reasons inflation actually ticked down in December, it fell slightly, was because gas fell 9% that month. So the gas price is about a nickel below where it was when Putin invaded Ukraine, shooting that price up. It's down about $1.50 from its peak last summer.
Well, what do you make of estimates? We could be over $4 a gallon again by March.
I think it's very hard to look that far around the corner. I think the president has taken decisive action and showed that he can provide some breathing room for people at the pump. The gas price, which is such an important price in our economy, down $1.50 from its peak in June of last year. And that means real breathing room for working Americans. But let's broaden it out, because I think inflation is very much underneath some of those numbers you just showed. The rate of inflation has fallen 6 months in a row. It is now considerably lower here than it is in the EU, than it is in Germany, than it is in the UK. And one of the reasons we have that is that favorable trend in inflation is because actions this president has taken to shore up and unsnarl our supply chains and to increase the supply of energy. Furthermore, moving into 2023, as the Inflation Reduction Act kicks in, we're going to see lower prescription drug costs, lower costs for health coverage, and lower costs for clean energy. So you can't get to where you need to go if you're not moving in the right direction. And we are moving there. Based on last month's jobs report, we're moving there with real alacrity.
Okay, so polls show us people don't feel it yet. They don't believe it yet. Our latest poll shows that 74% of people say they do believe we're going to have a recession this year. Now, you and I have talked about this. You know that perception impacts spending. People have pulled back on retail spending. Many Americans are holding off on major purchases.
Yeah, and I think, you know, look, I have no sense of whether we will head into a recession, except for the fact that, and I think Bernstein comes back and says at this point, like, we just added 500 and what was it, 40,000 jobs, 17,000 jobs. I mean, it's just an extraordinary amount of jobs.
And like lowest unemployment rate since 1969.
Yeah.
That is not indicative of a recession. And the interesting thing is that there are significant layoffs that are happening in the tech world, because you have a lot of like these tech startups and a lot of these outfits, not even startups, ones that have been here for a long time. They don't make any money. Mm-hmm. They're not cash positive. The money they operate is all based upon loans that they have taken.
Which is shocking how a business model like Uber or like DoorDash or something like that does not make any money. It's just shocking to me, given how little they pay their workers. But
what they do is they borrow huge sums of money that basically provide for them operating costs, and maybe, you know, if they're trying to operating costs, maybe they're trying to expand. They borrow this money, and they essentially live off of their future potential value. I mean, that's what you do ultimately when you borrow money anyways. But these companies are all valued at exorbitant valuations. And the idea is that we just keep growing and growing until somebody buys us out. Or we just simply go public and sell the shares and we pay off our debt, or we just keep rolling the debt. That breaks down when the cost of money goes up like so much as it has. So you're seeing that in these sectors, but across the economy, you're not seeing it as much. Now, it's conceivable when I look at this story from the Wall Street Journal about how much people have depleted their savings that they had, that maybe this goes down. The spending goes down soon because we're a consumer.
And what the Fed is doing with its interest rate hike, which is eventually the workers, regular people are going to bear that cost.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And it really is, because ultimately, look, the bottom line is, for decades, these classical economists said that there is a minimum number of people that need to be unemployed in your economy. Otherwise, the economy falls apart. Like, literally, it's catastrophic. And that number was north of where it is today. I think it was like 4 or 5%, the natural rate of unemployment. Mm-hmm. You never hear anybody talk about it anymore because it can be completely discredited. But the bottom line is, they are terrified at the idea that you could have full employment. And despite the fact that the Fed has a dual mandate, it is supposed to keep inflation low, and it's supposed to keep employment high. And these things are supposedly in tension with each other. But I would argue they are not in tension with each other at this moment.
It was laid bare, and the interest rate hikes are the regular people are going to bear the brunt of it. And there has been no mechanism to address corporate price gouging, which is at the root of at least some of the inflation that we saw over the past half of 2022.
Price gouging and logistics,
right?
And then, you know, sort of extraordinary situations in terms of like energy and costs, and in some food sectors, you know, like the avian flu has caused like egg prices to skyrocket because you've killed literally millions, if not billions, of chickens in the country. And so this is what we're looking at, but this is what we're watching the Fed do is discipline labor. And it is, you know, the slowest route possible to dealing with inflation that to the extent that we still have it, right? I mean, it's falling. You can't go back and sort of somehow reverse engineer when shipping containers were all over the world and they weren't on their natural routes. You can't go back and look at the bump in lumber prices. Those have fallen significantly. Maybe in part because of pullback on building as a function of interest rates, but also in terms, again, of supply lines.
And if the Fed was a bit more disciplined, they would have let that run its natural course since we were in such an extreme situation. But they chose to instead, probably with the pressure of people that hold debt, investors, to raise interest rates. I cannot believe they're doing it for an eighth time after these positive inflation numbers have come out.
JR in Philly writes, Bernstein, my point is that 3.4% unemployment is not recessionary, and it's really hard to argue that it is. Again, I think we have some structural problems with the quality of work that we have in this country. And wages, but wages are going up, not necessarily as fast as they should. They're not close to where they should be in terms of relative to productivity, but up is the direction you want them to go. Before we get into, let's start with this. This is Kevin McCarthy trying to make the argument that the problem in this country, because I guess the balloon just blew over, as it were.
It
no
popped.
Pun intended. Is the biggest danger facing America is the increasing debt and deficit. What he will not tell you is that the deficit was cut by like $1.5 trillion over the past year, which is, again, if you were worried about these things, that's the direction you would want it to go to. A big part of that was also increased revenues that were unanticipated because the economy has been so gangbusters. But here he is trying to sound reasonable about this. But again, what are you going to cut?
And like many of you, I worry about a future that feels less secure than it should. A lot has changed in recent years. Our southern border was once secure. Now the number of illegal immigrants who cross our border in just 2 years easily exceeds the population of 25 states. Americans are getting hammered by high prices. Today, nearly two-thirds of all Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, struggling to make ends meet. Meanwhile, China is infiltrating our culture, our farmland, and our skies because they see us as weak. This is not sustainable. But of all the dangers we face, the greatest threat to our future is our national debt. You deserve the truth. So let's start with the facts. Our national debt is high, too high. And the problem is getting worse, not better. We are now $31 trillion in debt. That is more than the size of the entire American economy, 20% more. Our debt is now a greater burden than it has been at any time since World War II. If we continue down this path, in the next 10 years, we will spend over $8 trillion just on interest. That's more than the entire federal budget this year by a lot. That is neither affordable nor sustainable. When debt is too high, inflation is the result. That is where we are today. Inflation has exploded. Mortgage rates have doubled. Working Americans, after inflation and taxes, have gotten a pay cut.
All right. So mortgage rates have doubled, not because of inflation. They have doubled because the Fed essentially doubled them.
Yeah.
By raising rates on banks. The debt, it really is sort of stunning. Here, put this up on there. I mean, this is like I just ironed it to you. This is the sort of like ridiculousness of this. If you look at like where the biggest jump in the debt, if they really were concerned about it, the biggest jump in the debt came in the in 20, from 19 to 20, presumably because of COVID. But I remind you, it was under Republican rule. The debt also creeps up 16 to 19. It goes up $3 trillion. I mean, the idea that this debt problem is in any way unique to the Democrats is just absurd. It really is not, in my estimation, a problem. There's no indication. We were told back in 08, frankly, that the debt got to a certain ratio of GDP, it would crash our economy. And it simply hasn't happened. This is money that we largely owe to ourselves. It is just a number on a balance sheet that fundamentally does not impact people's real day-to-day experiences. It just doesn't.
And if they're concerned about it, we can repeal the majority of the Bush tax cuts that were made permanent.
And the Trump tax cuts.
And the Trump tax
10 years ago.
That would do a whole lot to reduce the deficit.
We could reduce the deficit and ultimately start to cut into the debt by doing that. In fact, we don't need to stop and just repealing those. We can raise taxes significantly. And personally, I think we don't necessarily need to do it for the debt, but if it makes the deficit and debt smaller and makes the Republicans feel a little bit more at ease with things, I think we should go back to where we were in terms of the taxation scheme that we had in the 1950s in this country when men were men.
Yeah.
And
Tax rate was 90%.
And the tax rate was 90% for every dollar over, in today's dollars, what would be $3 million. So if you make $3 million, where you make $3,500,000. First $3 million is subject to whatever the 35% tax rate. And then that $500,000 that you make after that, you get to keep $25,000 of it.
Yeah. That it's just a way to nullify their debt argument, because whenever they bring that up, and they only bring it up when Democrats are in charge of the White House, it's a way to stave off any conversation about confiscatory taxation.
Yep. Actually, let me just say correct that. You get to keep $50,000 of that $500,000.
Very nice.
So there you go. Let's go. Oh, let's talk about. Okay. So here is where. So when they talk about cutting the deficit and the debt, the Republicans, it's either the woke parts of the military, and I'm not sure what that is, but the other part is Social Security or Medicare. They can't cut that. So here's Matt Gaetz going to reveal what they're going to come after. And remember this now. The way that they're going to cut Medicaid, this is already going backwards on reversing the COVID stuff, emergency stuff. We could lose somewhere from 5 to 15 million people off of health insurance, Medicare, because of that COVID emergency. Here is Matt Gaetz on the Joey Pags show.
Now we've got a one-size-fits-all Medicaid program that really, I think, drains our economy. It causes inflationary spending, and we ought not treat Medicaid the same way we treat Medicare and Social Security. We should attack it with great vigor of reform to make the program available for people who need it, who are truly needy and disabled, and we don't thin the soup in the Medicaid program with a bunch of people who could go to work and choose not to.
I mean, the best route that Republicans have is to attack people living in poverty.
Yeah.
And the idea that we have unemployment, I mean, that there are huge swaths of people who are just sitting on the sidelines, not working, so that they can get eligible for Medicaid is just bizarre.
Yeah. Was it he also who was advocating for work requirements for SNAP recently? Or was that a different Republican? I'm trying to remember, but we did cover that as well. One Republican was saying the same thing, but that's literally undercuts the reason that SNAP and Medicaid are in place. It's to help people who don't have the capacity to make the amount of money that they need to afford healthcare or food. It's just their easy scapegoats. Who was it?
It was Gaetz. Gaetz said this at one point, but also Budget Chair Jody Arrington.
There you go.
Also said it as well.
Which means that is probably the closest thing right now that they have to a cohesive strategy, I would say, Sam.
Yeah, this is where, like, this is their sort of last refuge, right? They can't cut Social Security and Medicare. It's broad-based. And so they'll go after Medicaid. I mean, this is why you have still, what is it, about 10 states in the country that have not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. And this is why they are all Republican controlled, is because it's easier for them to attack low-income people.
Yeah.
And just like those polls that show that Biden hasn't done anything on, let's say, drug costs, when in fact he has, not enough, but he's done stuff like, you know, insulin that's a big deal, $35 a cap under Medicare. A lot of people who are on Medicaid also are very skeptical about what government does for them. And there needs to be a better job of communication with that. And we need to just basically provide it for everyone.
Yeah.
So that we don't have to make this argument.
Well, that is exactly the argument for universality of programs, because if you create a wider net, a wider safety net, and one that applies to everybody, you're able to stave off some of the lower hanging fruit for Republicans, where they're going to attack programs that are specifically for poor people. So we need broad-based programs that everyone can enjoy, people get used to it, and then it's much more difficult to cut, which is why we see that with Social Security and Medicare.
Exactly. That's why Trump is out there, don't cut those things.
Yeah.
Because it's going to affect everybody. And then they immediately go, well, maybe we can take this out of poor people's pockets. Let's talk about this. We got to do this report from the Commonwealth. We know we're going over, but we got to do this.
Yeah, speaking of healthcare.
New report came out by the Commonwealth Foundation Fund. This is a big, it's like the top like healthcare think tank in the country. There's some highlights here, or lowlights, as it were. Healthcare spending, both per person and as a share of GDP, is far higher in the United States than other high-income countries. Yet, we're the only country that does not have universal coverage. We have the lowest life expectancy at birth, highest death rates for avoidable and treatable conditions, the highest maternal and infant mortality, the highest suicide rates. We have the highest rate of people with chronic conditions and obesity, nearly twice the OECD average. And here's the amazing thing. Americans see physicians less often than people in other countries and have among the lowest rate of practicing physicians in hospital beds per 1,000 population. So we pay more.
And look at that.
For less. All right, let's start with this.
The healthcare spending one?
Here's the healthcare spending.
Yeah.
Look at this. Ours is way, way up there. What's interesting is that it goes down
recently.
And I wonder if that's not a function on some level of like of so many people getting on Medicaid during the pandemic. I'd be curious as to what that's about. It's fascinating. And part of it is also we know that there's subsidies in the Obamacare. Now, understand, this is both public and private outlays combined. So this is the argument that you hear when Bernie Sanders would say it's going to cost more for the government. Obviously, I've seen estimates at $2 to $3 trillion extra a year in terms of health insurance outlays. But that's still significantly less than people are paying in private sense.
It's 17.8% of U.S. GDP as of 2021. And the next closest is the U.K. at 11.9%. They have issues with their healthcare system, too. But like their model is something that perhaps the United States could at least borrow from some elements of it. And that's just like, I mean, that's a significant drop off. Everyone else is comparable there, right?
Yeah, the next highest is Germany and France.
Oh, Germany, sorry. That's not
at 12.8%. I mean,
yeah.
We got a 5% more in terms of our percent of our GDP. And on dollars, we're twice as much. Go down, go to the next one. 3 to 4 times more on healthcare than South Korea, New Zealand, and Japan we spend. We spend, I don't know, 35-40% more than Germany, which is the next closest. You can see both are out of pocket's a little bit less than Switzerland, but our government expenditures twice as much.
And in terms of out of pocket as well, like we'll see later, people are going to the doctor a lot less.
Yes. And we should say that the blue lines here are not just government, but also like health insurance. So it's private on both sides. It's just like, how much do we pay like with co-payments? And it's higher than everywhere else except for Switzerland. They're all bankers there. Good. Go to the next one. It is the only high income country in the world that does not guarantee health coverage. I mean, I don't know what to add to that. You can see that like the blue is some type of like compulsory or government sponsored health insurance. Everybody gets to 100%. We get to like, I don't know, 38%, I guess. And not even, 'cause that's 38.1. 38.1 is the government compulsory health insurance relative to the private. But they have different levels of private. I mean, if you look in Switzerland, 100% government compulsory health insurance. And then they have like additions. In UK, same thing. This has to do with what percentage of the population has private and public. 100% have public access in UK. 10% have, I guess, private, voluntary insurance. So they all have, and then you have like Japan, Norway, Sweden, where they're like, we don't even have private insurance.
What's that?
Don't need it.
I do not know her.
Don't have this voluntary thing. We don't need that. We are already taken care of. Keep going down. And then we get to the outcomes part of this equation, which is equally as embarrassing. The U.S. life expectancy at birth, 3 years lower than the average of the OECD. That is the organization. What is it? That's basically European countries and really basically industrialized countries that have developed that we consider. Now, there's two things that are working on this in terms of U.S. life expectancy at birth. Well, one thing that's working at birth is that the big thing is, well, there are two things. One is that we have the highest rate of infant and maternal mortality in the OECD. So at birth, your life expectancy is 3 years lower. But it's not just at birth. Pop up that other one. They didn't have this in this chart, but pop up the other one about life expectancy at age 65. If you look at that, U.S. is way down. Go scroll. You see where U.S. is? It's down near, right just above Estonia, below Colombia. For men and women there, you should see. The men are in the diamond, and the women are the
Our
dot.
Our heads are blocking a little. Just scroll down a little. Yeah, yeah. There we go. Boom.
And that's men and women. And you have Japan and Korea and Spain and France and Switzerland, Australia, Luxembourg, Italy, Sweden, Finland, Belgium, New Zealand, Chile, Canada, Iceland, Ireland, Norway, Israel, Portugal, Costa Rica, Slovenia, Germany, Austria, Denmark, Netherlands, Greece, United Kingdom, Brazil, Colombia are all doing better than the United States in terms of life expectancy after the age of 65. So, in other words, you get to be 65. How long do people live after that? And if you were to break this down in terms of income, too,
oh boy,
it'd be nuts. It would be nuts. Our outcomes suck. That's the other part of this. It's one thing if you're out there spending twice as much as any other country on health insurance, on health care, and you're getting somewhat better outcomes, significantly better outcomes, proportionate to what you spend outcomes. But no, our health outcomes are worse. Go back to the other one in terms of infant and maternal deaths. Next one down.
Both.
Well, avoidable deaths.
There we go, yeah.
Per 100,000, higher in the in the U.S. than OECD.
336 per 100,000.
That is presumably health deaths that are avoidable. Not 100% sure how they define that, but nevertheless, we can see this data broken out in other places. Scroll down.
No one's even close with 200 per 100,000.
We have the highest rate of infant and maternal deaths. What's the point? What's the point of having the wealthiest country in the history of the world? We can't keep babies and mothers from dying at birth.
I mean, I would also like to see that broken down by income and race, because we know that black mothers, black people who can get pregnant, give birth, have much higher maternal mortality rates.
I mean, it's crazy. We have almost one kid per live births. Dies more than the rest of the OECD. And in terms of maternal rate, we have 10 mothers who, 10 more mothers per 100,000 live births who die. It's crazy. Go down to obesity. We have higher rates of suicide. We have significant higher rates of death from assault. The obesity rate is nearly double the OECD average. And of course, when you contemplate the idea that we see our doctors, have a distant relationship from our doctors, and the way that our food systems work, I mean, it makes sense.
It's also probably informed by the chronic conditions we'll see, I think, on the next chart as well, which can include diabetes and things like that. Right.
We are most likely to have multiple chronic conditions in this country. These are all just health outcomes, folks. And then here, we're getting into COVID. We have, and this is going to be nuts. This is going to seem absolutely insane, folks, to you, because we know that we have been told that the reason why people, now we are being told by some of these peaks, the reason why people are dying of COVID is because they got vaccinated. But weirdly, U.S. has the highest rate of death because of COVID-19 anywhere else in the world. And then scroll down to the next one. Keep going down till we get to one more. Yes.
Influenza.
We have COVID-19 vaccination rate is still lower than many of our peer nations. In other words, we have the highest rate of COVID deaths. But even though we have been told by a lot of people out there that the COVID vaccination is causing this, we have a lower rate of COVID vaccinations. In fact, we are just below the global average. Sweden, Norway, UK, Germany, France, New Zealand, Canada, Australia, Japan, and Korea higher than us. Netherlands and Switzerland just tied with us, just about. Go back up to the visiting the doctors, too. Yep. One more. I think there's one more, right?
No, that's
okay,
it.
There it is.
Yeah.
We also have the lowest rates of physician visits and practicing physicians.
One of them, but yeah.
I mean, not quite the lowest.
But lower than the average by a significant.
By a significant.
Margin.
And that's a function of, A, the cost to go see a doctor. And that's a function of how many practicing physicians we have, because that business has basically become overrun with bureaucratic red tape from the insurance companies and huge expense on the front end. So there's two solutions to that. One, you take the middlemen out of providing health insurance and just have the government do it with no profit motive. And two, you fund people going to university. It's pretty easy.
Mm-hmm. So there isn't, you know, say hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt that you might have to accrue to become a doctor.
Right. And then you only provide, you only provide healthcare for people who can pay exorbitant fees.
Yep. It's just, it's absolutely insane. And like, I just keep coming back to in the Democratic debates when, in 2020, discussions about Medicare for All and things like that. And there was a lot of rebuttal about, well, if you love your plan, you can keep it, right? Medicare for all who want it. Who the hell loves their plan? And then sometimes they'd say, well, if you love your doctor, you can keep it. I'm sure there's people that love their doctor. I get it. In the United States, we don't have people who can even see their doctor. People can't see a doctor because they can't afford it. There's not like this deep connection that a lot of people have with their physician, because a lot of people just don't have a physician. They'll go to a minute clinic, or they can't afford to go see a doctor at all.
I don't think there are a lot of people who love their plan, but I do think there are a lot of people who are afraid that it could get worse, which is not an unreasonable fear based upon, because we've never had a situation where they've gotten better until you get on Medicare.
Right. Exactly.
And the part of the other problem is, in terms of like educating people on this, is that, you know, something like 80% of our healthcare costs are borne by 20% of the people. You don't know that you have a shitty plan until you really need it. And I mean, I am less like, frankly, like, I have become less concerned with like those Medicare for those who want it. Like, okay. It won't take long until people realize that is there. And as long as you force all physicians to take Medicare patients, that if you were to put like a cap on or a minimum of a certain percentage of your patients need to be Medicare, if it's a Medicare for all or Medicaid, whatever we call it, certain percentage of your patients, 80%, I think there are ways of getting around the need to get rid of private insurance, because we see plenty of places around the
But the funding mechanism from taxation has to be universal,
without a doubt.
I mean, we're like no bullshit. Like, you get to opt out because you're a part of a private plan.
No, of course not. I mean, it's like public education. You want to send your kids to private school, you do it.
Right.
But still got to pay your taxes. And how do you do that, asks Adam from, what's the punishment violation fee?
What do you
mean? Just, your reimbursement rates for Medicare are less, or you lose your license. I mean, it's pretty easy.
Yeah.
We have all sorts of ways of making sure that doctors don't do bad things. All right. Went a little bit over. I'm going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Of the show, 646-257-3920, 646, what is it, 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM the show through the app at majorityapp.com. That app is free. If you become a member, however, you get to search the entire archive of our shows, and you allow the show to survive and thrive. Become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Your support is what keeps the show trucking along. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. You can get the Majority Report blend. People love that coffee.
Yeah. And shop.majorityreportradio.com. I'm looking at it right now. Limited edition pre-order for the M Majority Report t-shirts. But also, damn, this red beanie's pretty cool. Like, I'm not really a beanie person. I'll usually wear a baseball cap, but I might get that or ask for it.
Saul saw an Emma Majority shirt I had at the house last night or this morning, and he's like, wait, what's this? Emma Majority. And he thought it was pretty funny.
He liked it?
Yeah.
That's good. We got the Saul stamp of approval.
Yep.
And this, yeah, this cool gray hoodie. I like that, too. I like these new colors that you guys got up there.
Yeah, we got some new merch in there. Check it out, shop.majorityreportradio.com. Emma, what's happening on ESPN?
Yesterday, we spoke at length about the Kyrie Irving trade, how we kind of both agree that Dallas lost. And there's a good chance he just doesn't even re-sign there. Team cancer. But regardless, we also had Jason Miles on of This Is Revolution, where we spoke about the NFL in general, and college football as well, NIL deals, what the modern athlete has to go through, as well as this kind of athlete class of people who are second generation professional athletes, and what that means for the sport at large, especially as more money goes back to players, which we advocate for, but it just creates an interesting dynamic. YouTube.com/ESPN show.
Folks, Matt is back tomorrow. In the meantime, check out Left Reckoning. They were on just, what, one night ago? I don't even
They're
know.
They're on tonight.
Oh, tonight.
Tuesday's
tonight. Oh, tonight's yep. Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Okay, yep. So check it out tonight. I don't know if Matt's going to be on. Maybe he's back in time. We'll see. Tune into Left Reckoning and find out. He'll be back tomorrow. All right, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back. Back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money.
Hell of a lot of bank.
A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.